So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. There are some people who are here for the first time. So basically, what we do on Sundays, we have different programs during the week, but what we do on Sundays, first we have meditation, as you now know, for approximately an hour, and now we have Dharma talk. Dharma is it's basically, for now, it means teachings of the Buddha. When we say teachings of the Buddha, we don't just mean only the historical Buddha, who lived 2,600 years ago, but there's been a whole evolutionary development of Buddhist teaching, because the Buddha's original teachings and words have been nourished by a continuous stream of enlightened teachers. Up to this day, who have been born into this world and have practiced deeply and have had their own realizations and experience. And each and every time, historical time, etc., they make the teachings applicable to the current situation, and that exists to today. So while we are presenting the Buddhist teachings, we are also presenting it in a way that is understandable and applicable, and not just theoretical. But before I return to what I began last week, looking at these 40 tenets of Thich Nhat Hanh, just for those who are new or those who've been here for a long time, are there any questions about the practices we did this morning, the practice of mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness of the body breath, the practice of dealing with thoughts, intrusive thoughts, and the practice of I have arrived, I am home. Are those practices clear? Does anybody have any questions about how to do them? Please just nod your head if that's the case, so I know. So is that the case? Everybody's clear about the practices and know how to practice, because that's what's most important. Yes?
I do have a question about breathing.
Mm-hmm. Good.
When I'm able to stabilize, mm-hmm. I do notice my breath is very short, mm-hmm. very short in-out breath. And I'm just kind of wondering if maybe that's normal for me, maybe that's my body, or could that possibly be something deeper that I should investigate?
Yeah, so the question is about breath, and Jerry says that when he settles down into his breath, he notices that his breath is fairly short. It's not a deep breath. There's a lot to be said about the breath and a lot to be said about deep breathing for both health reasons and other reasons, to kind of get more air in there. But in when you're practicing simply like today, mindfulness of the breath, you are just present to your breath as it is. Okay? Because the key is not on the breath, the key is on mindfulness. Right? We are using the breath as a way to develop our capacity of our mind to be present. And because the breath is a continuous process of every human being while they're alive, right? It's a wonderful place to start. Awareness of the body is a wonderful place to start because it is always with us. It is with us in the meditation hall. It's with us when we go driving. It's with us when we're at home. It's with us when we're in work. It's with us when we're shopping in Publix. It's always with us. So learning to become aware of our body and our breath, and learning to align our awareness with that, is very stabilizing. Okay? Right. But mindfulness, the capacity, you know, one uses that stability one is developing in mindfulness of the breath to move out. One is mindful of one's surroundings. right? One is mindful of what's going on in one's sensorium. One is present to what one is seeing, to what one is hearing, to what one is smelling. And over time, one learns, most importantly, how to be mindful of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, the mind, because that's really the source, and we'll be talking about it today. Now, having said that, you might notice, gee, my breathing's very shallow, constricted perhaps. So there may be other times when you're not in formal meditation when you might want to experiment with taking a deeper breath. Okay? Seeing if there is a holding that goes on. So, I mean, there's all kinds of good teachings about the breath and taking a fuller breath and a more relaxed breath that are probably beneficial both to the body and the mind. But when we are in meditation, we're not trying to control anything. That's very important. Mindfulness is different than other types of meditation. Usually, meditation, the emphasis is on making something happen, right? Controlling and manipulating. But mindfulness is really just simply turning on the light of awareness. Learning to just be present and aware to whatever is arising. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations in the body, thoughts, feelings, perceptions that arise in the mind. Can we just be aware of what's going on, aware of what's arising, be present to it, and not react, not grab, not push away, not be attractive, not be aversive, not struggle, not fight. So we're cultivating a mind that is calm, a mind that has equanimity. And for most of us, that's not our mind. Things are always arising, and we're either liking or disliking. We're constantly engaged, grabbing on to things we see and hear. You know, you're sitting in meditation, all of a sudden somebody's going by with a boombox, and all of a sudden you're going, disturbing my meditation. Right? All that's happening is a sound is arising to the ear. Is that clear? That's all that's going on. And all that chatter is because our mind has an aversive response to that and then starts creating affliction. But the affliction is not coming from the boombox. The affliction is arising in our mind. Is that clear? So we want to be able to see that. So that's why when we sit in mindfulness, you know, whatever is seen, whatever is heard, whatever is smelled, and as I said, whatever we're learning, what arises in the mind, all kinds of thoughts, good thoughts, bad thoughts, wanted thoughts, not wanted thoughts. Can we just learn to just be aware of what's going on without grabbing, without pushing away, without struggling, without commenting on, without interpreting? We sit in mindfulness with a sense, everything's fine in this moment. Sitting here in awareness, relaxed and aware, everything is fine. Okay? My breath is fine. All the sensations that are arising in my body are fine. The sounds that I hear are fine. I'm fine. You're fine. It's all fine. Please notice how different that is from the other mind, the mind where nothing is fine. There's always a problem. There's always something to be dissatisfied about. There's always something to whine about. There's always something to complain about. There's always something that's missing. There's always something that's needed, right? That's called the mind of suffering. So we're hopefully in our mindfulness meditation learning how not to cultivate the mind of suffering, but cultivate the mind of well-being. That was a long-winded answer, sorry. So again, short answer, that's fine. Long answer is, you may want to explore. at other times, just your breath, the quality of your breath, how it is during the day. And you might find again that you're holding, constricting. You want to be relaxed. Any other questions about meditation? The practice of I have arrived, I am home. Good. So, for those who were here last week, you know that when some of us were recently in Plum Village, Thich Nhat Hanh's community in France, there was distributed this thing called the 40 Tenets of Plum Village, which is sort of a compilation of teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh that are kind of deeper. They're more Buddhistic, they're more philosophical. There are many teachings that people who are familiar with his teachings, his popular teachings, may not be aware what a great scholar and master he is. So as I said last week, some of them are quite not easily understood, such as the first one: space is not an unconditioned dharma. It manifests together with time, matter, and consciousness. Okay, is that clear to everybody? So I won't go into that one. That's really a matter of people who really want to go deeply into the Buddha Dharma. But some of them, I think, are more understandable and relevant. And so, as you know, let me see. Last week I did number 15, which is the awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness and also help prevent the creation of wrong actions and the planting of negative seeds that will bring about suffering. So this is a very wonderful, simple, and for those who are interested, it's on the website. So the talk from last week is on the website, and you can listen to it. But because the existence of suffering in our life, in the life of people we love and care about, in the life of the world, is omnipresent, and is often we have a real reluctance to deal with it. We spend most of our life trying to get away from it, or deny it, or repress it. The understanding that the awareness of suffering helps us recognize the potential for happiness and the conditions of happiness that also lie within us. And the meditation and reflection on suffering also is a strong antidote to our continuous creation of wrong actions and endlessly cultivating negative seeds. But I talked about that last week, so we don't have to talk about it this week. What I want to talk about to begin to talk this week, and again over these next weeks we'll talk about different ones. Let me begin with number 3, which may sound a little heavy duty to someone. Okay, but this is number 3. Nirvana is the absence of ignorance and the afflictions, but not the absence of the aggregates, the sense spheres, and the domains of existence. Is that clear? All right. So let us look at this to see if we can see what he's getting at here. Nirvana, okay? In Buddhist teachings, they talk about samsara and nirvana. These are Sanskrit terms. Samsara has, again, many meanings. It really, in one sense, it could mean it means this world. This is the world of samsara, which means this is the world in which suffering takes place. It is the world of birth and death. It is the world of change. It is the world that just seems to perpetuate itself, endlessly moving on a wheel that endlessly, while it goes up and down, sometimes better, sometimes worse, sometimes happy, sometimes sad, sometimes peace, sometimes war. When we take a bigger picture, we see it just seems to keep going, right? It is the world of suffering. It is the world of it is this world that human beings live in where they can't seem to get out of. And that all their efforts to try to find peace, all their efforts to try to find love, all their efforts to try to find inner harmony, etc., never hold up for any length of time. Right. So we're always kind of going up and down, in and out, happy, sad, peaceful, angry, not suffering, suffering. And in Buddhism, that whole endless movement that never gets resolved, and this is samsara. And it just continues. If you believe in many lives, it just continues lifetime after lifetime. Okay. It is said it's like a wheel. It just keeps going round, right? It's sort of like the proverbial, like the hamster or the rat, you know, in the cage with that thing that goes around, you know, they just, because you're going around, and they never get the cheese. They want the cheese, right? They want fulfillment. They want meaning. They want purpose. They want happiness, right? And something, you know, when they, you know, it goes around, and sometimes it seems to be right there, right? Right? Goes around, haven't seen any cheese, now, cheese. And then, but the wheel just takes you around again. And that poor rat keeps what? That hamster. Anybody ever get a hamster when you were a kid? Right, the hamster was endlessly going round and round. So that's the world of samsara. I mean, there's a lot more can be said. In the Buddhist teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the opposite of samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is free of suffering, free of dissatisfaction, free of unhappiness, free of meaninglessness, free of boredom, free of stress, free of this endless up and down, back and forth, this emotional roller coaster that so many people are on. This mind roller coaster that so many people are on, just endlessly spinning around. Okay. It is the absence of that that is nirvana. Suffering has ceased. Now, so this is nirvana, and he says nirvana is the absence of ignorance and the afflictions, but not the absence of the aggregates, the skandhas, the sense spheres, the ayatanas, and the domains of existent dhatu. So this is very important because he, and again, this is the, you know, fundamental Buddhist teachings, but he's stating very clearly what nirvana is. Nirvana, it comes to exist when ignorance is absent. And the afflictions, the emotional afflictions, the coverings, the kleshas are absent. Okay? This is very important and very practical, even though it may not seem. So nirvana is not a state to get to, right? Some people think, oh, you know, it's like a physical, you know, samsara is physical. Like this is the world of samsara. And then somewhere else, there is this world of nirvana, right? If I could only get there. So this is not saying that. They're saying nirvana is simply this with the absence of ignorance and emotional afflictions. When those are absent, nirvana is revealed. This is very important because many people, and there are many Buddhist teachings that teach that you know, we're here and we got to get there, right? It's again, it's kind of a geographical leap. But do you remember when we bowed to the Buddha just a little bit ago? And Salima said, we bow to the Buddha and to the Buddha nature within each of us. Okay. So what is a Buddha? A Buddha is a human being who has realized their Buddha nature, their awakened nature, which is already here. It's not somewhere else. How does a human being become a Buddha? They eliminate their ignorance, which is supporting all their emotional afflictions. When the covering is removed, when the ignorance and misperception is removed, everything is clear. It's already here. It's, what is it like? It is like when someone is, their eyes are covered, we might say they are what? Blind. They cannot see. And so everything is dark and they stumble about, don't they? If they're in a, if they happen to be walking on an open line like this, their walking is straight and easy. But if they deviate and they start walking into the cushions and the mats, they start stumbling. But they really can't see in advance, so it's all they can do is experience it as it happens. Sometimes it's clear sailing, sometimes it's stumbling about. Why? Because their eyes are covered. Right? That could go on for years. But one day, if that covering is removed, what happens? They see. And hopefully with their eyes open, they can always see the clear path. And they can see the cushions, so they'll no longer stumble. Okay? Ignorance has been removed. They see clearly what's in front of them. Right? If someone is in the woods or the mountains and they're lost, they have no idea where they are. All they can do is what? Go up this path, go down this path, go up this path, but they don't know where they are. So they just stumble around. They're lost. They want to be free. They want to get somewhere, but they don't have a clue. They're lost. So this I'm trying to describe is what Buddhism, when they talk about ignorance. Ignorance means our minds do not see clearly. We do not see things as they really are. Now that's a big subject. Okay. But it's a fundamental misperception. Right? Where there is truly impermanence, ordinary human beings see permanence. Right? Where there's nothing but instability and change, human beings seek permanence and stability. Right? Where there's meaninglessness, people seek meaning. Where there are sources of suffering, people are looking for happiness. Where there are things, nothing is solid, everything is interconnected, people don't see that. They see separation. They don't see interbeing, interconnection. They see separateness. So when Buddhism talks about ignorance, they're talking about that basically because of our misperceptions, we do not see clearly what is real, how things really are. In Buddhism, they talk about the three marks of existence, right? again, that things are impermanent, anicca. And yet human beings look around the world and they want permanence. So they're always dismayed when things change. Why? Because ignorance. And this is this fundamental ignorance. We don't see that everything is interconnected. Everything is made up of parts. Me, you, we are just in process. Our minds endlessly moving, thoughts, feelings, perception. It's like a river of our minds are just a river. Our bodies are not solid. They are just a river made up of all kinds of sensations and parts. I am that way, you in that way, and yet we see each other as permanent, sort of like cartoon characters, one-dimensional. We don't see things as it really is. Surrounded with a world of meaningless, unsatisfactory activities, we what? We jump into them looking for satisfaction and meaning. Thinking stability, desiring some kind of stability, we grab on to things that are fundamentally unstable. Okay. Why is that? Because of this fundamental avidya, ignorance. Okay. Now, the manifestation of this fundamental ignorance that really covers everything are these kleshas, these emotional afflictions, these mind states, these heavy mind states of sadness and despair and worry and fear and anger and resentment and jealousy and envy, right? And there's a list of them, okay? And they cover our minds too. So we can't even see this fundamental ignorance, right? It's like we can't see, the clouds are so thick and dark, we can't see the blue sky. Or when we're up in the plane, the clouds are so thick, we can't see the earth, right? It's there, but we don't see it because of these clouds, okay? But the earth is there, is here. And the blue sky is there. So he says nirvana is the absence. So when through spiritual practice, and especially through meditation, when we have been able to calm and clarify the mind, when we've been able to free ourselves from the dominance of emotional afflictions, and when we've been able in this growing clarity of a mind to use meditation to look into the mind and to see the very source of our misperceptions, so we can stop doing it. When we stop doing it, we no longer create the emotional afflictions. Now we have the capacity for creating something very different in our life. Okay. Now the important thing, as he says, is nirvana is not only the absence of ignorance and the afflictions, but it is not the absence of the aggregates of sense spheres and the domains of existence. I won't go into that, but basically what he's saying is the five aggregates are like us. Our body, our form, our thoughts, our feelings, our awarenesses, our stuff, our issues, and our consciousness, and all our senses, our eyes, our ears, our nose, and smelling and hearing and tasting, all the thing that makes up a human being don't have to be absent to experience nirvana. Is that clear? So many people think, oh, I got to get rid of this body. I got to get rid of these ears, or these smelling, or these tastings, or these eyes. They're the source of my delusions. No. There's nothing wrong with having senses. There's nothing wrong with having a mind. There's nothing wrong with having thoughts. There's nothing wrong with having emotions. Okay? That's a human being. Nirvana has nothing to do with any of those, other than that we misuse our senses, and we misuse our minds, and we misuse our emotion to create suffering, covering. Is that clear? The purpose of a spiritual path is to liberate us from our misperceptions, from our delusions, from our ignorance, to transform our emotionally afflictive life into a healthy emotional life. It doesn't go on in an alternate universe. Our spiritual awakening, our freedom from the world of suffering, our experience of nirvana is not going to go on somewhere else. It's going to go on right here in our daily life experience, our seeing, our hearing, our smelling, our tasting, our touching, our feeling, our thinking. So this is classic Zen, right? Classic Zen means, and it goes back to the Buddha. Because the Buddha, when he had his great awakening as a human being with two arms, two legs, five senses, all his aggregates and all his senses intact, when he had his awakening, he realized that all human beings, that means all of us, have this pure, undefiled Buddha nature. And that it's not simply a kind of abstract nature, but it is very alive, and it inherently has a natural wisdom to it. That's what he awoke to. Okay? He didn't become a Buddha because he studied Buddhism. That's very important to understand. He did not study Buddhism, and yet he came to awakening. And yet he freed himself from suffering. And this fundamental experience, you know, it's like knowing, no matter how, let's say, no matter how polluted a body of water is, if you take that water, that polluted water, and if you put it through a process such as reverse osmosis or something else, you can take out the impurities. And when you take out the impurities, what is left? Water, pure water. So it was always there, right? You see, it was always there. The water was all, the purity of the water was already there, but it was toxic because of the impurities that had entered it, right? And distillation or reverse osmosis or other processes are ways of removing the impurities, and then you don't have to do anything, do you? Because the water, its nature by itself, is pure. Is that clear? So, even if you look into your mind and you observe your mind and you go, wow, what a mess. Right? Talk about pollution. Talk about toxicity. Right? Can you see? And yet, the wonderful positive message of this is not inherent to your mind. Okay? This is all additives that have just been added and added and added. Why? Why did we let this happen? Because we were ignorant. We didn't know better. What? We thought grasping at this and pushing this away and wanting this and needing this and liking and disliking and loving and hating, you know, getting and losing, protecting, advancing. We thought, oh, this is the way to be happy. We didn't know better. It's not because we were bad people, but we were ignorant. I mean, I don't know. Do you have a problem calling yourself ignorant? I have no problem. I mean, it's a fundamental ignorance. Is that clear? It's a fundamental misunderstanding. I mean, in Buddhism, one of the most fundamental misunderstandings we have is we think that we're solid and real. We think there's a self, an ego that's permanent and solid, and life's all about is meeting its needs and wants and defending it and advancing it, right? Keeping it safe or getting things for it. And Buddha said, no, this is not true. The self that appears this way and feels this way, when you look deeply into it, you see there's nothing solid, permanent there at all. I mean, talk about a game changer. Right? If you spent your whole life self-absorbed, self-possessed, and whether you think you're a wonderful self or whether you think you're a terrible self, whether you think you're a self that's better than others, whether you think you're a self that's worse than others, what if there was no self at the center of it? Can you feel the liberation of all that self-thinking? Of all that self-concern? What if that wasn't there? How would you have drama? I mean, try to have drama without a self, because drama is always about who? It's always about me and them. So again, this ignorance about the fundamental way things are is not just abstract, can you see? It's very meaningful. And again, to understand that we have this pure, true nature that has its own natural intelligence, its own natural wisdom and understanding, and because it does not see separation anywhere, it naturally is open and in relatedness to everything and everyone. To love is not going to be so hard. To accept is not going to be so hard. Because the cause of that which separates, the cause of that that always sees distinctions, the cause of that that's always judging, and the cause of that that's always grasping and seeking, is no longer the activating principle of your life. And it occurs within your own body, mind, as it is right now. Okay? That's what he's saying here. Now, let me just add, and then we'll take questions. Number 5, and this is very important, because again, many people go, whew, this is deep stuff, right? This is deep, deep stuff, and wow, this is only for the spiritual giants, right, to experience nirvana. Must take lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes of hard work. In a certain way, it does. But I want to read number 5. It says, it is possible to touch nirvana in the present moment. Okay. It's very important. It is possible to touch nirvana in the present moment. Okay? So many people, they're waiting sort of like they practice Buddhism like they're waiting for an act of God. Somehow, enlightenment is going to just rain down on me one day. One day I'll just stumble into nirvana, and everything will be good after that. Right? Like nirvana is a state of mind, or a geographical state. It's not like that at all. As it said earlier, nirvana is the absence of ignorance and the absence of emotional afflictions. Okay. Now, where do you experience suffering in your life? But that's the geographic place. But in the realm of time, where do you experience suffering? Right now? You experience it right now. You may be thinking about the past, right? But if you think about where do we suffer when we suffer. I mean, it sounds kind of simple when I say it, but I mean, suffering exists in the moment when we are suffering, right? I mean, if you think about some situation that caused you to suffer, and you start feeling the suffering again, you're feeling the suffering right now, even though you may be thinking about the past. You're thinking about the past right now. Are you with me? If you're worrying or anxious about the future, you're worrying right now. Your experience of suffering is occurring right now. Right? You're grasping, you're desiring, you're averting, it's all happening right now. You may have memories of it happening in the past. You can fantasize about it happening in the future. But if you're doing either of that, you're doing it when? Right now. Can anybody try to worry in the future? I mean, can anybody worry at about 11:45? Right now. You laugh because you can't do that, right? Can anybody worry about 11:15? No. If you want to worry, when are you going to worry? Right now. If you want to be sad, when are you going to be sad? Right now. If you're going to be angry, when are you going to be angry? Right now. Then you're having a real experience of it. Okay? So, the world of suffering, the world of delusion, the world of ignorance, when does it manifest? It manifests moment to moment in the present moment. All right. Which means what? If ignorance and the kleshas are removed, as it said in verse 3, then in this moment we have the capacity of touching nirvana. Now please, this does not mean we're fully realized Buddhas. He says touching. Okay, realizing is more ongoing than that. Okay, but again, understand that life unfolds only in the present moment. You know, letting go of the past, letting go of the future, the past is gone. You know, all this stuff are not just nice spiritual thoughts, right? They are the truth. Is that clear? They're the truth. Obvious to anybody. We have been here since 10 o'clock. It is now 11:35. Anything that happened in the last hour and 35 minutes is gone, doesn't exist. We might have memories of it, we may think about it, we may talk about it, but that's, we're talking about something that has gone. Is that clear? And anything that is going to happen after 1136 has not happened yet. Is that true? You may think, oh, you know, when this is over, I'm going to go out for lunch or I'm going to go meet somebody. But that's just a fantasy, right? You're just imagining that. That hasn't happened, has it? So when you understand that, you know that reality only exists in the present moment. If I am going to suffer, or if I am going to touch the absence of suffering, I can only do it in the present moment. This is the opportunity. If I missed 25 million opportunities in the past, that's past. If I'm only thinking about how I'm going to do it in the future, that's fantasy. If we want to touch nirvana, we can only do it in the present moment, which is this moment. When I'm sitting here, this is the moment. When I'm sitting there, it's the same moment, but looking the other way. Right? When we walk out into the hall at the end of this, each of those steps is a present moment. When we meet people, encounter people, that's the present moment. Life is just made up of moments. That's all life is, one moment after the other moment. And so the challenge is, in this moment, for each of us, what do I want to touch? Do I want to touch the world of samsara, the world of suffering, the world of delusion, the world of ignorance? Or do I want to touch the world of non-suffering, the world of happiness, the world of peace? What do I want to touch right now? This is very powerful. Because again, samsara, nirvana, I mean, people who read about Buddhism talk, they can go on forever and ever talking about samsara, nirvana, the same, is it different? But this is much more direct. Samsara and nirvana are things that arise within the stream of our own body mind, especially our mind. And if we want to liberate ourselves from our delusions and our suffering, when do we do that? Moment to moment. Nowhere else. Setting good intentions? Good. It points us in the right direction. But if we don't practice in the moment, not much help. Having kind thoughts for beings, having compassionate thoughts for beings when we're on the meditation mat. Good. But it's in the moment when we are with a human being or when we are thinking about a human being. How is our thoughts then? Are we cultivating compassion? Are we cultivating patience? Are we cultivating understanding? Are we cultivating the mind of love? If we are touching nirvana, the absence of suffering. Love is the manifestation of interconnection, interbeing, non-self. That is always available to us. It is available to people who've been practicing for 50 years, and it's available to people who've been practicing for 5 minutes. What's the difference? From an absolute position, there's no difference at all. It's available to everyone equally. It could only be that the person, hopefully, who's practiced longer knows it better, knows how to do it better, and is doing it more often. They say one minute of presence, 1 minute of mindfulness, you're a one-inch Buddha. If you want to be 2 inches, you have to get the next moment right. 3 inches, 4 inches. But if you just have 1 minute and 1 inch, and then the next 25 minutes, you're all over the place, you'll always just be building 1 inch Buddhas. So if you want to build a bigger Buddha in your mind, you have to be consistent. You have to begin to create more moments of touching nirvana, less moments of touching the world of delusion and suffering. Is that clear? And that's really how it works. So we have to take these very large, big, abstract, philosophical principles of samsara, nirvana, and ignorance, and take it right into daily life, and right into the moment, and realizing, oh, yeah, I have that opportunity of choice. In this moment, what am I going to touch? Whether I'm in the meditation hall, whether I'm driving, when I'm at home by myself, when I'm with friends and family, love with colleagues, wherever I am. Here's my choice. What do I want to touch in this moment? You see, it's not about what we're doing. It's about how we're relating to what we're doing. What we're doing is, you know, everybody's doing something different, right? We all have our lives. We're all doing something different. Different experiences, different professions, different types of people we're in relationship with, different family members, right? That's all different. But where we come together is, how are we relating to all those moments of experience at work, at home, with family, with friends, in society? That's where we say in the beginning, let us practice as a river. We all flow together. Well, we all are different. We all have different life and experiences. But where we flow as a river is that we are learning how to relate to all the moments of our life with something that is the same, with mindfulness, with presence, with openness, with acceptance, with understanding, with compassion, with loving kindness, right? That's our commonality that allows us, that's the river we flow in. It's the river of practice. It's the river of cultivating the awakened altruistic mind. It's putting an end to endlessly touching the mind of suffering and manifesting the mind of suffering moment after moment after moment. Many of us, as I said earlier, out of our ignorance, we don't even know that. Right? And if you don't know the difference, how can you know what to choose in this moment? So this kind of talking we're doing today or studying of Dharma is helpful. So we know the difference between samsara and nirvana. We know the difference between suffering and the absence of suffering. We know the difference between an afflictive mind state and a non-afflictive or a healthy mind state. When we really know that, because we've reflected on that and studied on that and observed that within ourselves and others, then we can begin to distinguish. We have discernment, it's called. We can discern the positive from the negative, the healthy from the unhealthy, the wholesome from the unwholesome. And then we can choose in the moment. What do I choose in this moment? If we're a totally enlightened Buddha, the choice is always made. It no longer is in choice. It is always manifesting. But for most of us in the world of practice, it's still in the realm of choice. Choosing how to be, but when our karma is moving us in a different direction, we can choose to stop. We can see what's going on. We are aware of our anger, resentment. We are aware of our grasping mind. We are aware of what's going on inside us and what the unhealthy things that may be driving the actions of our body, speech, and mind in this moment. And we can choose to what? To stop and to do something different. So again, many people, we talk about free will, but they don't have free will because they're just always driven by their conditioning. Again, like the blind. We can't expect the blind to see, can we? No. That's why we provide the blind with what? With guide dogs, right? And other means to help them navigate the world. But the blindness we're talking about today is not a physical blindness. Okay. It's a covering. The Buddha said it's like a dust. Some people, the dust is very thick over their eyes, so they really can't see, or it's always very murky. We need to remove the dust from our eyes, the coverings from our hearts. How do we do that? Well, we do that through practice. Practice of study, reflection, meditation practice, mindfulness, concentration, insight. Oh, so, but that's another talk. Quickly, are there any questions? I realize a lot's been said here. Is anything... Yeah, it's all pretty clear. So those are two of the tenets. Nirvana is the absence of ignorance and the afflictions, but not the absence of the aggregates, the sense spheres, and the domains of existence. And it is possible to touch. That's what I want you to remember. It is possible to touch nirvana in the present moment. So we'll stop here. And I'll continue when I teach next week.